Okay, so we are starting a completely new unit right now this evening, and it is called The Wisest of All Men. This is Melachim Aleph, Perek Beis, Perek Gimel, Dalet, and Half of Hay. That's going to be our work for the next few weeks together. We're going to now look at the formative years of Shlomo HaMelech as he becomes the Shlomo HaMelech we know and love. But sometimes before he becomes the grand king, there's the moments of growth that we see and we watch as he rises into his place. So that's the name of the entire unit. We're going to go section by section. This section within the unit is, he had a dream. Definitely the speech was taken from this sheer, naturally. Here's how it works. So we're going to look at the first half, essentially, of Perek Gimel. Okay, the third Perek in Melachim Aleph tonight. And this is our starting point. There are, for those people who are coming in, there are two packets just over here on the tables over here. One is the texts of the actual Melachim. The other one is the actual unit of Mepharshim. Please make sure you have both of them. One is a color cover and one is just black and white. Okay, so here is how it goes. We're going to look at two ideas, two items on the agenda for tonight are the following. Agenda item number one is Shlomo's marriage. Agenda item number two is Shlomo's dream. That's what we're going to do. Two basic things. So here's how we go. As usual, we'll take a look at the unit of text first, and then we'll think about some ideas. So, in the text, if you don't have a Tanakh, you're welcome to join in the actual text packet with the color cover. Here's what it says. We're looking at the first two psukim of this perek. Vayischatein Shlomo es Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Shlomo arranged a marriage with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Vayikach es Bas Paro. He marries the daughter of Pharaoh. Vayivi'el ir David, he brings her to the city of David, ad kalosoi livnois es beisoi ve'es beis Hashem, until he finishes making his house and the house of Hashem, ve'es chomas Yerushalayim saviv, and the wall of Jerusalem around. Shlomo is in charge of three building projects. One is the Beis HaMikdash, one is his palace, and third is going to be the wall of Yerushalayim. So before all of this has happened, he brings her to the house, the ir David. The people are still sacrificing on a bamos. What does the word bama mean, literally? Bama is some sort of altar before the Beis HaMikdash was extant. At this point, between the destruction of the Mishkan and the evolution of the Mikdash, we have this gap in time where people can bring their korbanos on their altars all around. And now we're told, there was no house for God at this point in time, and that's why it is. So here's our first section of the Perek. Let's take a breather. Let's try and appreciate what we're being told over here. So we're first told that there's this marriage, and it's a striking marriage. We just have this package just up there. There's a striking marriage in that he's marrying no less than the daughter of Pharaoh. So you think to yourself, wow, you know, like, that's the first thing we learn. You know, we've seen Shlomo taking care of the internal affairs in the last unit. Now the first thing we know is he's marrying the daughter of Pharaoh. Why in the world is he marrying the daughter of Pharaoh? Why is this going so? A very tenable suggestion is now let's shift to our Mepharshim packets. In this section, the first source, the Malam tells us, Vayischatein Shlomo, achar sheichin malchuso bekerev amo, after he has already now arranged his kingship internally. So the state has been secured internally. All internal revolutions have been squashed. Internal affairs have been accomplished. Now he establishes it in terms of foreign policy too. The nations surrounding him. So this is a political marriage. He marries into the kingdom of Egypt to secure the southern border, essentially. Now, this is fascinating. Where do you see this, by the way? Where do you see this clearly in the words of the Psukim? How do you know that the Malbim is right on target over here? Where would you know this from? So the truth is because it says he marries Pharaoh. He was not marrying Pharaoh. He was marrying into the family of Pharaoh. But the point is that marrying the daughter of Pharaoh was really to marry into the family of Pharaoh. That's what the pasuk seems to indicate. That's number one. It wasn't that he was at a political conference once and he met this young lady. That's not what's happening over here. This is clearly a political alliance, the first thing we're told. So then this raises a few questions, right? Because halachically speaking, there could be a few questions we could wonder about in terms of Shlomo's decision. What questions come to mind? Shlomo's decision, yeah. She's a non-Jewish lady. How is he allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman? Moreover, I mean, this is the king of Israel. Moreover, in fact, by the way, so how do we know there is such a prohibition? The Torah says, Loisis chaten bam, don't marry them. You go into the land, you're not allowed to marry them. And Torah is pretty explicit about that. What else? What other questions could we raise about Shlomo HaMelech? Yeah?
What does this have to do with bringing korbanos?
Right, so it's interesting. So how does there seems to be two issues in these two very short psukim. One is about korbanos. One seems to be about this marriage. Very strange and obscure. Also the context of this in general. There's another question as well, which should also be worthwhile thinking about. And that is that you're not allowed to marry even a converted Egyptian within three generations. The Torah is pretty explicit. There's certain nations who are in a kula. They have a waiting list. Amon Moav, right? There's a certain the Mitzrim. Amalekim never, right? Amalekim never has an ability to do it. But there's almost a probation period. The probation period isn't a few years; it's a few generations. So even if let's say we're going to say that she converted, it's hard to understand how this worked out. So the Gemara actually struggles with this. We're not going to do the whole Gemara, but let's take a quick look at the Gemara in Yavamos, which deals with these issues. The Gemara raises these questions. The Gemara is not shying away from this. Here's what the Talmud says in source 2. It's all in the box. Meisiv Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef asks the question, Vayischaten Shlomo es bas Paro melech Mitzrayim. Wait a second, how could he marry her? So the Gemara says, no. Giru Gaire. He converted her. Clearly, there was clearly a conversion process that went on. The Gemara then asks the following question. V'holoi kiblu geirim lo bimei David v'lo bimei Shlomo. So it says because they never really accepted converts at the time of David and Shlomo. Why not? Just what was the logic behind that? Right. You know, it's interesting today. It's fascinating. It's really remarkable. Sometimes you wonder, there's some incredible souls, incredible searching people who make their journey and find their way to Judaism, and they find their way in. As families in South Africa, there's families of people converting in outlying communities in America. And you have to wonder sometimes, you know, meaning like, you know, Jews aren't, you know, liked that much in general. I mean, like, read the news. And it's an amazing thing. There's obviously some sort of inner dynamo of truth, which is, and we know it's true. But for a person on the outside to say, I'm going to leave the comfort of my life and my lifestyle and to adopt Judaism in such a climate is remarkable. But when it's all going well, right, when Shlomo and David HaMelech are succeeding, and everybody says, I want in, the reason they want in is because we all like to be the people buying into the company whose stocks are going up, right? So therefore, says the Gemara, they didn't accept Gerim at the time when there was such success because there might have been ulterior motives. So therefore, the Gemara is questioning, how could it be that ultimately Shlomo HaMelech even accepted her as a Giyores, as a convertee? So the Gemara concludes, interestingly enough, it says, no. Here's how the Gemara concludes. Midi hutaima, ela l'shulchan melachim. The Gemara says, wait a second, the reason why they weren't accepted in those times was because they wanted to get to the power of the table of kings. Ha'alait srichole. So in this case, Bas Paro didn't need him. The more powerful of the two nations at this point in time was Egypt. So there was no concern that Shlomo was thinking, well, she wants in because she wants more royalty because she already has it. So therefore, in this particular instance, there was no concern over here in terms of her Gerus that there would have been this ulterior motive. Fascinating discussion. And then the Gemara asks, the Gemara goes on to say, but wait a second, she is a first-generation Mitzris. She is a first-generation Egyptian convertee. And we know that there's a three-generation waiting period, which means, by the way, what does that mean? Is there's going to be a community of Egyptian Jewish converts for the first generation who marry each other, and the second generation, and the third generation of that community can marry into dispersed into Israel. That's what it means, right? So it's a sub-community, so to speak. Right now, not the Egypt of today, just out of interest, right? We're talking about the Egyptians of the Egyptian time. But be it as it may, she is clearly the real Makoi. So the Gemara actually says, you know what? Maybe it wasn't even a marriage. Maybe the Gemara gives one suggestion that maybe it wasn't real marriage. Another suggestion the Gemara discusses is maybe that limitation was only to Egyptian men, but not to Egyptian women, much like we've seen by by Rus as the Moaviyah, as opposed to the Moavin. So the Gemara entertains various suggestions. What halachically the outcome is actually an interesting discussion. The Abar Benel says, just this is an interesting thought process. He says, from reading these two psukim, what does the Tanakh seem to be telling us about Shlomo? Is the Torah, is the Tanakh indicting him? Or is the Tanakh describing what happened? Which seems more likely from the two psukim we've read? It sounds like it's descriptive. It doesn't sound like the Tanakh is giving us a judgment at this point in time. Later on, it is interesting to notice that Shlomo HaMelech unfortunately does veer off the path at the end of his life. And we're going to see that he marries a number of non-Jewish women. And again, conversion process. And it mentions Bas Parah. And it says that Hashem got angry because of this. So how do we put the two things together? So the Abar Benel says, look, at this point in time, this is a bit of a dangerous conclusion to come to. But the Abar Benel says, Halacha was still in the formation at this point in time. The whole discussion of whether it was Egyptian ladies or Egyptian men and ladies. This whole discussion was in flux at this point in time. The Gemara itself solidifies the halacha and we pass in one way in normative halacha. But at this point in time, Shlomo HaMelech, whether mistakenly or perhaps he did have what to rely on, made the right decision. This is this point in time when he was doing this. He was doing this altruistically. He was doing this with the Shem Shemayim. He believed this was the right thing to be doing, ultimately, when he married her. Later on in life, it got more insidious. They influenced his mind, influenced policy, influenced decisions, tone, we'll see, of the kingdom later on, and he was held accountable for that later on. But at the very beginning, in fact, it was good, which is, by the way, a general pattern we're going to see as it goes through Malachim. Well-intended individuals who do something which potentially on the books could be have a leg to stand on, but ultimately, as it manifests itself and as it festers, it becomes more questionable. And this is one of these things. And we have to trace this moment over here. But this really raises, just before questions, one last point over here. And that is that why is this here? Meaning, did Shlomo HaMelech not have any other wives? Why is this the first thing we're really hearing about? It's about state policy. So the Malbim would tell you, well, he's secured the country internally. Now he's going to secure the country externally. That's how the Malbim views the flow of events. But there is another way of looking at this, and with this we'll close this rather enigmatic section. And this is what Rashi says over here. Rashi is now the source to be found on the bottom of page 2. Why is it here? Rashi tells us, Vayischaten Shlomo, V'kolzman shoyo shim'i raboy kayom, lo yischaten boy, mikan amru lo'olam yodur adam bimkom rabo. Rashi says that Shimi ben Gera, who Shlomo had to execute, because his father had made that one of the last of the list of his responsibilities. Shimi, who was ultimately actually the teacher or one of the great sages of yesteryear, when he's no longer in the picture, that's when an innocent mistake slips in. And this mistake now becomes a problem. It's going to sow the seeds for future problems in Shlomo's life, which means the way that Rashi is reading this is ultimately a continuation from the end of the last perek. Shimi's killed, his teacher's no longer here, the influence is lost, he makes decisions which perhaps if he'd asked or if his teacher were around, he'd do differently. I remember, sort of speak in a personal sense, I remember that when I was in the yeshiva in Israel in Baltimore, so what they would do is as many yeshivas do, they would have one of the rebbes who would come and sit in the dining hall with you for the meal. So from time to time, I'd take the opportunity to go and sit at their table. Whoever would want to, could I take the opportunity? And I remember Rav Moshe Eisman, who should live and be well, one of the greats of the last generation. I would sit with him at the meal, and I noticed self-reflectively that I ate a lot more calmly and menschlichkeit when I was sitting and eating with him. Because when you're in the presence of somebody else, when you're in the presence of somebody of such pristine self-purification, of such personal growth, you act differently. And that's what Rashi says. La'olam, Rashi had said, Yodur Adam b'mekom rabo. You should always be in the influence of somebody that you wish to will, to aspire, to want to be better in front of. And when that influence disappeared from Shlomo HaMelech's life, that's what's happening over here as we see this, there's this devolvement. And what's interesting is again, it's not a problem at this point in time. At this point, it's innocent. At this point in time, it's all right. But it's ultimately going to manifest later, which is something a teacher, an honest teacher, would really tell or at least influence the Talmud. And this is what we're seeing over here. We've not addressed the question about the Bamos, or why people are sacrificing, which is what Joel raised. We're going to come back to that in just a moment, which is the next section. Freddie Lieber.
Maybe our Professor Fagus is explaining why it was okay for him to do something that was kind of in a gray area, because they didn't yet have halacha, and they didn't yet have the Beis Hamikdash, and they were still...
It's a slippery slope. You've got to be careful. You're meaning to say, so there is certainly halacha right now, and the one of the halachas is that when the Mishkan or Mikdash is not in place, then sacrifice is allowed in numerous places. So the Mishnah in Zvachim and Kufyud Beis and Beis talks about this. And this it says, when the Mishkan was destroyed in the times of Eli, then Hutra Abamos until the Mikdash was made. So it's this particular flexibility in this aspect of halacha. But no other halacha was flexible. What the Barbina was arguing, which is what you're referencing, is he says, you know, there's a number of opinions as to whether it's all the Mitzrim are excluded, or just the Mitzrim males. And although we paskin, it's all Mitzrim, at this point in time, he said, that had not been decided upon in halacha, and Shlomo had the liberty to choose one of those opinions before the Gemara closed it.
This pasuk certainly can't reflect on to why he behaved that way.
Correct, exactly. Because otherwise, we don't want to say that society is... Actually, this is one of the most pristine times in Jewish history. We're entering into the golden era, which I like to think about in terms of the Koheles era in a second, because... that's what we're going to reflect on tonight. Okay, now we're into them. This was really the preamble. This was essentially the closing of the last era. The person who put the prakim into Tanakh was not Jewish. Okay, so the perek by perek was not a Jewish person, which is why that is not always a good assessment of where we are. This really, perhaps we could have put the perek right here, and this could be a conclusion of the last perek. Now, we're into now the new era, and this is where it gets very fascinating. We need to do a little bit of thinking together on this next section. Our next section leads us from Pasuk Gimel to Pasuk Tezvov. We're now going to read about the dream of Shlomo HaMelech, a very unusual dream that he has. Okay, so let's take a look at this inside the text. Vayehav Shlomo es Hashem, lo leches b'chukos David aviv, rak baba mois whom is a mezabeach umaktir. So we see that Shlomo loves Hashem, and the only thing is that he is sacrificing on the bamos. Again, is this sort of this footnote over here. You do see something interesting, by the way. There is only one person in all of Tanakh who says he loves Hashem and Hashem loves him, and that is Shlomo. The reason why Shlomo's other name is called, does anyone remember?
Yedidya.
His other name is Yedidya, which means the dear one of God, because Hashem loved him. So he's the only person in Tanakh who we're told loves Hashem and Hashem loves him. That's a pretty strong starting point. Vayelech HaMelech HaGivona Lizbaach Shem, he goes to Givon to sacrifice, Kihi Abama Gadola, because that is the large altar. Elef Olois Ya'aleh Shlomo Al Mizbeach Ahu. He brought 1,000 burnt offerings. Folks, that is a lot of offerings, right? That's a lot of animals. Go to your local farm and ask how much a goat costs. It is a lot of money, right? So this is a lot of money. There's a lot of effort. So this is obviously not a day project. B'givon Nira Hashem El Shlomo. And then in Givon, he had apparition B'chalom Alala at night. V'yomer Elokim Sha'al Mo'etein Lach. He says, this is the question we all wait for, right? You know, it's the lottery ticket, the blank check, right? So, Shlomo, what is it that you would like? So imagine, just at this point, we have to pause for a moment. Imagine if you had that dream. What would you say? What would you say? I was driving along the highway the other day, and this wasn't God speaking, but, you know, the billboard says, you know, $220 million in the Powerball. And I said to myself, what would be the next step? What would you do with that? And that's just, that's a microcosm, because, there's a very, very minimal chance. Yeah, Hashem can deliver. What would you do if you got anything you wanted? So Shlomo, in his dream, fascinatingly enough, so obviously some degree of his subconscious or some degree of his prophetic self is interacting with Hashem. Ato asiso im avdecho David avi chesed gadol kasher halach lefonecha be'emes uvitzdako v'yishrei lev imach. You did such kindness to my father David, who followed you in such righteousness and truth and such honesty of heart. And you guarded his great chesed. And you gave him a son who sits on his throne today. So by the way, this is just important for today's generation. Usually when you give somebody of today's generation something, this is not usually the first response you hear, right? I don't understand. Why isn't it red? I wanted the candy in red. Right? You understand? The requisite response when somebody asks you for something is to appreciate what they've given you beforehand. Right? That's the first step we see that Shlomo is telling us about etiquette. V'ato Hashem, and now, Hashem Elokai, Hashem my God, ato himlachto es avdecho tachas David ovi, you placed me in the place of David, v'anochi na'ar koton lo'edat seisovoi. I'm a young man, I have no idea about going, coming, I'm very humble. Among your people which you chose, Am Rav Ashola Imonevali Sofer Merovid, nation which is uncountable for its multitudes. So step number two of etiquette is that, you know, you get hired, you don't get the corner office. You don't get the corner office after the first 3 weeks. Right, millennials? Right, this is not how it works. Right, that's the next step over here. Shlomo Melech is saying is thank you. And you know what, I'm not really worthy of the position you gave me. Now that we've got that straight, Hashem, now we can have the conversation. Okay, so Shlomo Melech is telling us how to approach Hashem. Please give your servant a hearing heart. For what purpose? Lishpotes amecha, lavin bein tov l'ra, to judge your people between good and bad. Umiyu kimucha lishpotes amecha, hakoved azeh, who can judge this onerous people? Right? So apparently things haven't changed all that much, you know, since Moshe Rabbeinu and onwards in Jewish history. He's right, so she says it's difficult to deliberate between these people. Please give me the hearing heart to be able to understand this. Vayitov adavar b'nei Hashem. Hashem was very pleased that he chose this. And God says to him, by the way, you'll notice, and we're not going to focus on this so much, but the oscillation between the names of Hashem. These are not the same names of Hashem, not the ones that appeared to him, not the one that spoke to him, not the one that was pleased in his eyes, right? Just notice the change that is going on over here. And God says to him, you didn't ask for longevity. You didn't ask for riches. You didn't ask to destroy your enemies. You wanted to hear, you wanted to understand, to understand judgment. I'm going to give you what you asked for. I'm going to give you a wise heart. No one before you ever had this. No one after you will ever have the same level of wisdom. I'm going to give you a bonus. I'm going to give you wealth and honor. No one before you has had honor of this kind. By the way, it doesn't say in the future as well. And the longevity piece, that's up to you. Right? So if you follow in the ways, then I'll guarantee that as well. There's always a tonight, there's always a condition. Now he says, Shlomo wakes up in the morning, v'inei chalom, it is a dream. We've heard that language before and in Parshas Miketz. Vayavo Yerushalayim, vayamod lifnei Aron bris Hashem. He stands in front of the ark of Hashem. Vayal olois, vayas shlomim, vayas mishteh lechol abadav. He brings sacrifices. He brings shlomim sacrifices before it was just olois. And he makes a feast for all his servants. This is his dream. This is his response to his dream. Very fascinating. There are so many questions. There are so many questions on this entire section. Just want to throw out a number of questions. And let's try to keep them in the air. And by the end, let's try to catch them all. Okay, so question number one is why is this happening in Givon? There's two places. There's an oscillation of place here. He goes to Givon. Anybody know where Givon is? Givon is in the area of Binyamin. Right, so he's going northwards. This is north of Yerushalayim. We've heard about this place beforehand in Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Beis at the beginning. The fight between the forces of Ishbosheth and David was at the Brecha Shebri Givon. Right, interesting place. Why is here? We have to think about that. Why it starts off in Givon, he comes back to Yerushalayim afterwards. We should be mindful of the shift in place over here. Why the prophecy was there? One question. Another question is that we're not going to get to this tonight. But the oscillation of the names. Why Hashem is relating to David HaMelech with different names, different apertures of connection, and why in the world did Hashem offer this to him in the first place? I mean, you say forget even his response. What triggered this? What catalyzed this moment that Shlomo got this? I mean, most human beings never in their wildest dreams ever got this question asked to them. No one. Why Shlomo? Why now? What's the context of this? Also, then how did he know the right answer? Like, where did he get this from? What's the point of his answer? What we're going to have to also do this is contrast this to his perspective about wisdom, where he talks about it elsewhere. Where else does Shlomo HaMelech talk about wisdom? Koheles and Mishlei. So we really ought to contrast his perspective on wisdom to his other writings, because we have what he says about Chochmah. Finally, we're going to have to consider what is the feast that he's making? Why is there a big feast? Why is his response this feast at the end? So a lot of questions to consider. What I'd like to do is start with some of the more basic of those questions. And the most basic of the questions is just the Lev Shomer. Why is it that Shlomo asked for a Lev Shomer, a hearing heart? I would like to, maybe it might seem frivolous, but I would like to direct our attention to the sixth source in the Mefarshim packet. This is a book I read many years ago, but it accentuates a point that I just think is incredibly important. How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. At the beginning of the fourth chapter, he describes the following situation. I'm sure we've all been in this situation beforehand. He says, for example, I met a distinguished botanist at a dinner party given by a New York book publisher. I had never talked with a botanist before, and I found him fascinating. I literally sat on the edge of my seat and listened while he spoke of exotic plants and experiments in developing new forms of plant life and indoor gardens, and even told me astonishing facts about the humble potato. I had a small indoor garden of my own, and he was good enough to tell me how to solve some of my problems. As I said, we were at a dinner party. There must have been a dozen other guests, but I violated all the canons of courtesy, ignored everyone else, and I talked for hours to the botanist. Midnight came, I said goodnight to everyone and departed. The botanist then turned to our host and paid me several flattering compliments. I was most stimulating. I was this and I was that. And he ended by saying I was the most interesting conversationalist. An interesting conversationalist? Why, I had hardly said anything at all. I couldn't have said anything if I wanted to without changing the subject, for I didn't know anything about botany more than I knew about the anatomy of a penguin. But I had done this. I had listened intently. I believe that one of the greatest gifts, and certainly in today's day and age, that we can possibly give any other human being is attention and time. Just being able to really listen. That is one of the greatest faculties that we have, and it's the one we most often drip other people of. Right? Where whatever distraction that we give, whatever solution that we render, whatever validation, just actually really listening to people is something we've completely lost. It's so fascinating. There's so many people who have everything, but they don't have anything. They don't have somebody who cares enough to care about their problems. I mean, think about it. When we're going through something really hard, when we have to make a really difficult decision, and we need somebody, we just want to talk about it. So many people don't have enough time to really care about the intricacies of our decision-making process. Those few people who care enough about it like we care about it, to find that person, that's a gold mine. That's the best thing we can ask for, the highs and the lows in our life, to be able to celebrate it. And I mean the highs as well. You know, imagine the following. Imagine you tell somebody about an incredible accomplishment. You know, you won a raffle in the office, and you come home and you tell someone, you know, I did this, and they're like, oh, that's great, you know, and they carry on. Right? They're not matching your energy in terms of validation. In a certain sense, you lost something there. There's something of you which you put out. You made yourself vulnerable. It's lost. Shlomo Melech understood the most basic idea, which is, I just want to be able to hear people. I just want to be able to hear. I want to just add one story just to give a little bit, just the power of this for a moment. And this is a story, it goes to the core of this. They say that there was in the old Yerushalayim, there used to be that instead of an ice cream truck, no ice cream truck would fit into those alleyways, there was a fellow who used to go around with a tea cart. It's one of my most favorite stories that I've repeated a number of times. And the way it would work would be that as the bell would ring, all the kids would run out of the cheder, they'd play in the yard, they'd throw balls around, and the tea truck would come and park outside, and the kids would come and they'd pay a few, you know, there wasn't agarot in those days, it was the subcategory of the lira, and they would give a little bit and they would get tea. So the tea man is there, the kids are at recess, and there's one kid in the corner who just keeps batting the ball against the wall. And so the man calls out, he says, Hamudi, ata rotzeite? And so the boy says, Ani lo rotzeite, ani sanerte. I don't want tea, I hate tea. All right. He carries on, he serves up all the crowds. In the meantime, while this is all happening, Rav Arya Levine is watching this all unfold. And he goes over to the tea cart. He pays the little amount for the tea, and he goes and takes the cup of tea, and he gives it to that little kid. The kid stops playing ball, drops the ball, takes the cup with both hands, and in one gulp swallows the whole thing. Finished. And so the man packs up his goods, the kids go back to the class, everything's fine. And the man says, as Rav Arya Levine is walking out, he says, it's so funny. He says, you know, it was nice that you did that. He says, but I asked him, you know, to be honest, I really tried. And he told me he didn't like tea, and he hated tea. So Rav Arya Levine says, yeah, he says, that's what you heard. He says, but I heard him say something else. I heard him say that my parents are dead, and I can't afford it, and it hurts me so much when I see the other kids getting tea and I can't get it, and that's why I continue playing ball. Wow. That's what I heard. So what Shlomo Melech is saying is, Lev Shomei, is can we really, really hear other people? Like, just understand what hearing is. Hearing is such a powerful thing. Yes, Esther.
So we ask for Leif Shomea, but Hashem answers that Hunei Natakecha Leif Chacham.
Excellent. Good question. So there's a little bit of a shift over here, and I would like to get it. I don't think we're going to get to it tonight. But there's a fascinating idea over here in terms of mind versus heart and the movement between the two of them. Okay, so maybe if we have a chance, maybe there's one depth of David versus Shlomo, which might be over here. What he's asking for, what he's getting for is a little different, which you're identifying. Exactly. There is another element to this over here, and we're not going to get into this too much now. The Ben Ish Chai does say a very beautiful thing in his Halachos. He says that the first Beis HaMikdash, which is what Shlomo is constructing, is about to precipitate, was dependent on the mind, so to speak, and that's why he asked for the idea of the mind. He says, but in the future, the third Beis HaMikdash is the first Beis HaMikdash is about Mishpat, is about judgment, quid pro quo, logic. The third Beis HaMikdash, which we're waiting for, he says, B'merav Yomenu, is going to be built on Chok. Chok means lack of logic, so to speak. So it's interesting, as the prerequisite for the first Beis HaMikdash, he needed a Lev Chacham, a Lev Shomer, to understand the justice of the people. But when we get to the third Beis HaMikdash, it's not going to be through justice, it's actually going to be ultimately, ironically, through, so to speak, the void, the black hole of justice, where we don't understand things, but we're still doing it, which is how teshuva works. Meaning, if you think about it, our generation requiring teshuva. Teshuva is not a logical process in many ways, because if you did really bad things, then you get really bad results. And how is that Hashem will sometimes allow us in certain cases? So there is a certain element of lack of logic which precipitates the third Beis HaMikdash. Fascinating discussion in of itself, just worthwhile thinking about the prerequisites for Bais Rishon, the prerequisites for Bais Shlishi. I'm leaving that on the sidebar. It's not as relevant to us right now. But nonetheless, let's go a little further. This is what Shlomo HaMelech asks for. Let's expand this a little outwards. So if you say at this point in time, on a scale of 1 to 10, how does Shlomo view Chachma, wisdom? What's this? What rating would you give wisdom at this point in time? It's like, you know, like an 11, right? Right, so I mean, it's like the blank check, and what does he ask for? He asks for wisdom. He asks for the ability to be able to hear. So, right, that sounds pretty good. The problem is that he writes about this in his other books. So he writes about this in Koheles. And in fact, one of the things that Koheles experiments with, Koheles is the Melech El Yerushalayim, which many attribute to be Shlomo HaMelech himself. So if that's true, Shlomo HaMelech talks about Chochma, and there, it's the first exploration that he has. And here's what he says about at the end of the first perek of Koheles. Take a quick look over here in our sources, in source 9, the very last page. Here's what he says, Ki barov Chochma rov ka'as, v'yosif da'as yosif machov. With much knowledge comes much anger. Right, read the New York Times every day, right? Right? Or he says, V'yosef das, Yosef machov. With more knowledge comes more pain. Think about this. The more we research certain topics, the more painful it is. Rachman and Litzon, when we research diseases, when we research, cataclysms which are likely to happen, when we read, the more, you know, Yellowstone is a volcano, there's a possibility of an eruption. There's an average earthquake in the Middle East every 100 years, and we're 92 years since the last one. I mean, look, the more we know, we'll just be a basket case, just thinking about all the terrible things that can go on and do go on. So what does Shlomo HaMelech say about wisdom? Too much, not good. Wait a second, Shlomo. And then he goes on. Actually, in the second paragraph, listen to what he says. Just flip back one source here to source 8, just at the top of this page. He says, "Konasti gam kesef zahava." I brought in a lot of gold and silver. He says, "Skulas melachim avedinois." All the treasures of kings. Va'asisili sorim v'saros tanuge b'nei adam v'shidah v'shidos. I had all the luxuries of commoners. I had everything that the coffers could contain. The godalti vosafti mikol she'ol lefonabi Yerushalayim afchach masi omdoli. I had everything everybody had before me, even my wisdom. The kol asher shalu einai lo yatzalti mehem. I never stopped myself from anything I wanted. Lo monati es libi lo mikol simcha ki libi sameach b'mikol amoli v'zeh yachelki mikol amoli. This is what I invested myself in. So you think at this point in time he should after getting his insignia printed on the top of his lapel, he should at this point in time say, that's it, that was a wonderful life. What does he say? All of this is empty. Wisdom, money, enjoyment, all these accomplishments are empty, including wisdom. So make up your mind, Shlomo, what is it? Is it the thing that you're asking for? Is this what you asked for at the beginning of your life, and at the end of your life you realize it's empty, but Hashem gave it to you? How is this all working? Which leads us to perhaps a very interesting conclusion. And that is the conclusion is ends versus means. Ends versus means. Think about it. What did he really ask for from Hashem? What was he really asking for? He wasn't asking for wisdom at all. What was he really trying to do? He says, I want to judge your people. I want to serve your people. Give me the vehicle necessary to serve your people. I'm on a mission. Give me the wherewithal to be able to achieve my mission successfully. What is Shlomo HaMelech talking about in Koheles? What's the construct of Koheles, this Koheles man? What is he looking at in terms of all these things, these implements? These are all the goals. They're no longer vehicles. He says, I want wisdom. I want money. I want pleasure. I want all these things as a goal. Says Shlomo HaMelech, if that's the way you're amassing it, then hakol hevel ruus ruach. It's all empty. It's not in and of itself a goal. It's a means. The blessing Shlomo HaMelech received from Hashem was because he said, I want this to be my means to serve you, to serve your people. So Hashem says, you know what? I'll throw in a few bonuses. You want wherewithal? I'll give you a little more wherewithal. Why? Because you're on a mission. There are people who have everything and they have nothing. And there are people who have nothing and have everything. Because if you have a goal, if you know what you're doing in life, then everything else corroborates that. If you don't know what you're doing, no matter how much else you're getting, it's not going anywhere. It's additional. It's wasted. That's what the Midrash at the beginning of Mishlei says in source 10. Shlomo Melech Yisrael, who's the king of Israel. It says in the 10th source, V'chi'ena kol yodim shu melech Yisrael. Do we not know that Shlomo is the king of Israel? Elo ma she'asa lichvoidon shel Yisrael asa. Everything he did was as a means towards serving the community. When that's the way it works, then everything else corroborates that. Everything else supports that. That is worthwhile. So what, perhaps, the subtlety, if we only read Malachim by itself, we would say, yes, he was a pursuer of wisdom in the purest form, and that's not the truth. He was a pursuer of service of the people. I once had the chance to have a private audience with Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and I just asked a question. I said, you know, he has a certain gravitas whenever you have a chance to be in the same room as him. And I said, you know, was that something that you were born with? Is that something you developed? How does, you know, there's certain people who have a presence. And he smiled and he says, a presence, a gravitas, is the byproduct of serving the community selflessly. It's not something you aim for. It's something which ultimately is a byproduct of what you're doing truthfully. That's what Shlomo HaMelech was doing over here. That's all he was doing. I want to serve your people, Hashem. Give me the wherewithal. Very, very different perspective in thinking about what he is asking for. Let's last small question, then we'll try to conclude, wrap up this idea. Why is he making this feast at the end? He gets this knowledge. He wakes up in the morning. Why does he make a feast, interestingly enough? So it is interesting that the Mephoreshim point out that in the morning, let's say you had a dream like this. What's the first thing you'd want to do in the morning? Hashem tells you, he's giving you a lev shomea, he's going to give you everything. So what's the first thing you're going to do? Let's try out the new toy, so to speak, lahavdil, right? How's he going to try it out? So the Chida says that he went outside and suddenly he could hear the language of the birds. Suddenly he had such a cerebral appreciation of every meridian within nature that now suddenly even the sounds of the bird meant something to him. And when he woke up that morning and he was able to hear that and he was able to hear the cadence of the ecosystem around him, that's when he realized it really was. It wasn't just a dream. And therefore he made a su'udas hoida'ah, he made a su'udah, a thanksgiving feast, because of his achievement. Which, by the way, interestingly enough, in halacha, has a place. This is one of the sources that a person should do a siyum upon finishing a mesechta. So to speak, we finish a corpus of material, of halachic material, of Torah material. So we make a su'udah. Where do we learn this from? Shlomo HaMelech, he did it, right? Once he realized he had it, he made the siyum. This is what he did. This is what the Ralbag says. This is what the Chida says over here. Very, very beautiful idea. Last question, and this is the most crucial. These are details. The most crucial question, and this is how we're going to close our learning this evening. This is the crucial question. Why now did Hashem offer Shlomo HaMelech this opportunity? Why was he writing this check? Why no one else? And to this, I would just like to quote the Mikdash Melech on Sefer Melachim, who suggests a very fascinating insight. And that is that there are two implements in the Mishkan, Qua Migdash. There are two implements which represent different modalities of the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. The one is the Aron, the Ark, which contains the Torah, and the one is the Mizbeach, the altar upon which we sacrifice korbanos. And if you ask David, and if you ask Shlomo, which one of these represents the point of this entire building, of this entire enterprise, they would give you different answers. In David HaMelech's lifetime, what was the focus of David HaMelech's preserving the Mishkan? What was the focal point of David HaMelech's service of Hashem when it came to the Mishkan? It was always the Ark. In fact, once the Mishkan had been destroyed, the grand achievement of David HaMelech was to bring the Ark back into Yerushalayim. He wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, but what did he do? He wasn't able to do that. He brought the Ark and he tried it twice. The first time Uzzah dies, he tries it a second time, he brings it into Yerushalayim, he sacrifices, he dances, there's the whole thing. That's why Michal criticizes him for how much he dances. This is where it belongs. The seat of power is in the Aron. Interestingly enough, where is Shlomo going? Where does this all take place? Where is this dream occurring? In Givon. What is in Givon? Why is he there? The Tanakh tells us because what was there? This Bama Gedola. Not just any altar, the great altar. Why is there a great altar in Givon? Very simple answer. Because that's where the Mishkan used to be before the Mishkan was destroyed. The remnant of the Mishkan, not the Aron because it's been brought to Yerushalayim, but the remnant of the altar is still there. Which means the two nodes, so to speak, of what the Mishkan represents. The altar is in the north and the Aron is in the south. David HaMelech's focal point was the Aron. Shlomo HaMelech's focal point was the Mizbech. In fact, even later on in Tanakh, when you ask Shlomo what it meant, he only talks about the sacrifices. That's what the Beis HaMikdash represented to him. As an example, let's take a look in source 4, just reversing for a moment. He says, this is the words of Shlomo HaMelech when he talks to Hiram. We're going to meet him next week. In Dvar Yamim's version, Hinei ani voneh bayis l'shem Hashem Elokai. I'm building a house to Hashem, my Lord. La'akdish li l'haktir l'fonav k'toris tamim u'ma'areches tamid vo'olois l'boike vo'l'erev. Why am I making a big Beis HaMikdash? To sacrifice there. He doesn't mention the Aron to be the seat of the Torah or the tablets. It is to sacrifice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what this means to say is we get a very interesting perspective. When Shlomo HaMelech is willing to engage the Mizbeach and not the Aron, that's when the puzzle or the circuitry is closed and Shlomo HaMelech is endowed with the chokhmah necessary to build the Beis HaMikdash. Why? We're going to read the words of Rabbi Yigal Ariel in source 5, and this is our closing today. He says, Chalom Shlomo beGivon nitzav efor ben shnei moikrei HaKodesh. The dream of Shlomo is found between these two, so to speak, nodes of Kedusha. Shlomo lo yischil es darko b'Yerushalayim lifnei Aaron. He leaves Yerushalayim, where the Aaron is to be found. Shibita es hashras hashchina b'Yisrael, which represents what? Hashem coming to us. What does he do? Elo yotzom Yerushalayim v'holach l'mishkan shebigivon. He went to the remnants of the Mishkan, which was now in Givon. That's why it was there. Because what is the base? The altar, ultimately. It's the place where we as human beings come closer to Hashem, rather than Hashem coming closer to us. Two different directions. The Mizbeach is us moving upwards, the Aron is Hashem moving downwards back to us. That's why the Tanakh emphasizes 1,000 sacrifices there in Givon. Shav Shlomo el Aron Yerushi Yerushalayim. Then he returned afterwards to make his feast in Yerushalayim by the Aron, to thank the Shechina which had now been achieved through his movement upwards. So what he's essentially saying is that how is it? Where's the starting point? Who makes the first step in the relationship? David HaMelech was always the focus on Hashem, come to us. Shlomo HaMelech says, we will come to you. When Shlomo HaMelech steps out of the holy city, out from the places where the nobility of society lives, into the areas of the proletariats, where everybody can bring the sacrifice and is able to sacrifice themselves and come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is the catalyst for the Beis HaMikdash. And this is perhaps what happens with Shlomo, which ultimately relates directly to his dream. What is his request? What does he want to serve? He wants to serve the people. If he wants to serve the people, then Hashem says, that's it, fantastic. We've connected all the circuitry. You have Chochmah. Now take it to the next step. And that's what's going on over here. Why now? Because he made the move. And now why did Shlomo ask for a Lev Shomer? Because that was the requisite response to that. What we have ahead of us, this ends today's section, what we have ahead of us is expressions both in Tanakh and in Chazal of the wisdom of Shlomo, some famous cases that appear in front of Shlomo HaMelech, and what they're really trying to tell us about Shlomo and what they're really trying to tell us about the people of the time. That'll be actually in 2 weeks' time. Next week, unfortunately, we will not be meeting, and I apologize for the choppiness. We'll not be able to be here next week, but in God willing, in 2 weeks' time, we will continue with this particular section. Looking very much for it. Thank you so much. Thank you.